Welcome to On The Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business, and the economy. On The Money is broadcast live from the studios of Radio 2SER and broadcast nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I'm Kevin Suarez, and on the program this week...
Bitcoin was born in 2008, in the middle of the GFC. And after that, you had the European crisis, which also showed that governments were not as reliable as we thought they were.
It seems that Bitcoin will now be going mainstream, and Veronica Alashina will find out what will be the future for the cryptocurrencies. All this and coming up, more on The Money. The RBA has had interest rates on hold now for the 15th month in a row. Its minutes and its tone on monetary policy have remained the same for much of that time, warning that low rates of wages growth and the high rate of indebtedness are a danger for the economy if there are any external shocks. But overall, the RBA has been more upbeat recently about the growth outlook and a reduction of government debt, albeit largely from bracket creep. Hans Lee asked Shane Oliver, AMP's capital chief economist, why he commented that the RBA was stuck between a rock and a hard place on interest rates, given that they were optimistic overall on the economic outlook.
Well, basically, the Reserve Bank expects that sooner or later, all this monetary easing and the pickup in the global economy will flow through to stronger economic growth in Australia, and that will push down unemployment, but more importantly, underemployment, which in turn will push up wages growth, which in turn will ultimately lead to a pickup in inflation. And that's why that they hold out this optimism that eventually they'll be able to raise interest rates again. So, yeah, we'll get there eventually, but it might be some time away. And we're thinking that they probably won't raise rates till the end of next year, possibly not until 2019.
It sounds like a lot of what-ifs.
Well, that's the nature of economics, I guess. It's always a lot of bulls in the air, a lot of uncertainty. Economic forecasts are known for missing out and getting it wrong every so often. And also when it comes to monetary policy, there's also this saying about long and variable lag that we know ultimately that low interest rates help the economy, but the lags can be long and variable. So, yeah, there is a lot of what-ifs out there. I think ultimately the Reserve Bank will get their day and rates will go up just as they are now in the US, but it's still some time away.
Continue with the RBA's minutes. This month, they said that growth and housing debt continues to be a concern for them. But doesn't the RBA's dovish position encourage borrowing and the low household consumption figures we've seen for some time now?
Well, that's precisely right. And I guess that's one of the trade-offs the Reserve Bank has to allow for. By cutting interest rates, you do provide a stimulus, obviously, to the business sector because you end up with a lower cost of capital for companies, but also the household sector, the amount of debt that Australian households owe the banks is more than double the amount of bank deposits that the banks owe the Australian households. So if you cut interest rates, yes, it's bad news for self-funded retirees. Their interest rates go down, but it is good news for homeowners and potential people buying a house. And, of course, the Reserve Bank doesn't want us to sort of go out there and buy houses en masse because that will just reinflate the housing bubble we've seen in Sydney, for example, in recent years. But it does want to provide stimulus to those households that do have a mortgage. You know, the typical family in the western suburbs of Sydney who've got a $400,000 mortgage, low interest rates do mean a lot to them. Even if they cut rates again, you will get a stimulus to those households, and they will spend some of that. The Reserve Bank has tried to sort of balance that out by saying, yes, we're going to have the low rates, but increasingly in the last 2 or 3 years, they've put pressure on the banks via APRA to limit lending growth, and particularly to what they regard as high-risk borrowers, people who are investors and also people who are only paying down the interest and not paying down the principal.
I want to talk about the cooling market actually right now. So how important is the price cooling we are seeing in the major cities, Sydney and Melbourne, actually to the RBA?
I think it's very, very important. They became very concerned a couple of years ago when prices kept rising at double-digit rates in Sydney and Melbourne. Over the last 5 years, for example, Sydney property prices are up 70-80%. In Melbourne, it's up 50% or something. That's a massive, massive increase. So the Reserve Bank has sought to try and cool it down. They're not as concerned as perhaps the government is about first-home buyers, because it's sort of a bit outside of their brief, a bit outside of what they can control. But they are concerned that that surge in property prices at the same time as a surge in debt could have set up a bubble which at some point could burst, and therefore they've been trying to cool that down to head off that eventual bursting. Now, hopefully, this does make life a lot easier for millennials trying to get into the market in Australia. Our property prices, even with a cooling, are still at exorbitant levels compared to those in the US.
Your position is that the RBA will hold out until late 2019. But I was also reading something from Stephen Koukoulis of Market Economics, who tweeted that the RBA should have cut interest rates now even further because of all those negative domestic indicators. Would a sudden cut have unnerved the wider economy?
Yeah, there are people who've been sort of saying they should cut again, and until early this year I thought they should cut again. But the reason I've sort of leant away from that is that, that there are enough indicators suggesting the Aussie economy is still growing. If you look at the labour market, we have had good jobs growth in Australia. The unemployment rate has come down. Business confidence is reasonably good. There's signs that mining investment, which was collapsing, is close to the bottom. Non-mining investment looks to be picking up. There's an infrastructure boom on all over Sydney. So it's not as if the economy is dead in the water and therefore needs a rate cut right now. So that's why I sort of differ a little bit from Stephen. I think on balance, you know, the Reserve Bank can afford to sit tight on interest rates at the moment. And it's fair to say, I think, that interest rates where they are at the moment is certainly not holding the economy back. That's not the reason why things are constrained. It's not low interest rates that are constraining things.
Finally, Mr. Oliver, a weak dollar has proved elusive for the RBA as they try to spike exports and create trade stimulus. But while we are still in a strong dollar zone, however, how do you think consumers can capitalise in these times?
I mean, it depends how you look at it. If you look at the Aussie dollar compared to where it was in 2011, it's down a lot. I mean, back then, one Australian dollar bought $1.10 US or 110 US cents, whereas today it buys about 76, 77 US cents. So it has come down on back then, but it's higher than the Reserve Bank would like it to be.
Where are the RBA wanting it to be?
They'd prefer it to be around 70 cents. And I suspect that this is another reason why they're not going to be raising interest rates anytime soon, and why you can't rule out another rate cut, because if the Aussie dollar continues to remain strong, or if indeed it goes even higher, then that will be a constraint on economic growth in Australia, because it will make our exports less competitive. Foreign tourists will say, well, Australia's too expensive for us, we won't go there. Foreign students thinking of studying in Australia might go somewhere else as well. And, of course, Australians might go on overseas holidays, which is one advantage of a strong Australian dollar. But when you go on an overseas holiday, as opposed to have a holiday in Queensland or Tasmania or somewhere, that money is lost to Australia. It's gone overseas. So all up, the Reserve Bank would prefer to see a lower currency. I guess if you're an individual Australian at the moment, you might think, well, given that risk at some point out there, the Reserve Bank will get what it wants, a lower currency, then maybe if you are thinking of going overseas, now's not a bad time to do so. At the end of the day, the Reserve Bank would prefer to see a lower Australian dollar. We need to see more foreign students coming to our universities. We need to see more tourists coming. We need to see our manufactured exports doing well, and so on. Best way to do that is to have a lower Australian dollar.
Does part of your projections for a rate hike in late 2019 also come down to those ebbs and flows, that you think it'll come back to about 70 cents by this, well, about this time next year?
Yeah, I'm hopeful that my forecast on the currency will be right and the Aussie dollar will head down towards 70 cents. And if that's the case, that will then make it a little bit easier for the Reserve Bank to raise interest rates. At the moment, if they were to raise interest rates, then I think it would push the Aussie dollar up well above the 80 cent mark. And I think that's one reason holding them back at the moment. But if we wait another year or so, the Federal Reserve in the US, even with the new Fed chairperson, Jerome Powell will have increased rates in the US a few more times. And as US interest rates go up and Australian interest rates remain on hold, then it makes it less attractive to park money in Australia internationally, more attractive to park money in the US, and all of that pushes the Australian dollar down. So, yes, I am hopeful that my currency view will come correct, Aussie dollar will fall, and that will be one factor which ultimately will help allow the Reserve Bank to raise interest rates late next year or sometime in 2019.
Shane Oliver, AMP Capital's Chief Economist, ending that report by Hans Lee. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Suarez, and you're listening to On the Money, broadcasting around Australia on the Community Radio Network from the studios of Radio 2SER in Sydney. Coming up next, we have this week's Please Explain.
Please explain. Please explain.
The bitcoins and the cryptocurrencies have been sort of managed in a decentralized system. Initially, it's a peer-to-peer system. So there is no third party. There is no financial institutions in between to formalize the transaction or to guarantee it. There is no government to also back the cryptocurrencies.
Bitcoin is a notoriously volatile currency. The price per Bitcoin increased by 800% in the last 11 months, from US$900 to $7,200. But soon, Bitcoin derivatives will be traded on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. I asked Dr. Marianne Kam, researcher and senior lecturer of economics, finance and marketing at RMIT, to please explain.
So having the Mercantile Exchange coming in, we get the guarantee provided by the exchange because they will be managing the contract. They will be clearing the transaction. They'll be ensuring that the transaction actually occurs, that there is delivery of the Bitcoin at the price agreed, or delivery of the US dollars at the price agreed in the contract. So it really provides some extra backing that we haven't had so far with Bitcoins or any of the cryptocurrencies.
So why is the Chicago Mercantile Exchange coming in? And what are the futures contracts that they will be managing?
So with future contracts, you'll be able to fix the value of the Bitcoin with respect to, let's say, the US dollar or another currency, to fix its value, although you fix the value of what you have. For example, currencies, if you buy some future contract on a currency and you say in 6 months I will trade it at a certain value, what you hold has got that value until the contract actually occurs and you do the deal. That removes what we call the currency risk, the fact that the value of most currencies as we know them go up and down over time. So let's say you decide that you're going to have a future contract where you fix the value of your Bitcoin at, let's say, $7,000 a Bitcoin. And until the contract actually expires, this is the value of what you have in your portfolio for one Bitcoin. What is happening is we've got the largest future exchange going to organize those contracts, so the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. So it is a massive financial institution.
To date, Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies have faced controversy due to decentralized operation and management outside of our existing economic system. But now, Bitcoin is going mainstream. What does that mean?
Well, it means two things. One is we do have financial institutions now managing Bitcoin or Bitcoin contract. So that's one big thing, because so far financial institutions have been kept out of it. So here what's happening is Bitcoin is actually being adopted by financial institutions. On this, by the same token, we also see government getting interested in blockchain and Bitcoins and other cryptocurrencies. So that's also changing. And both those things are leading Bitcoin to mainstream. For individuals, that they can also somehow use the future contract, but those are more at a larger scale. So that would be more for institutional players. The last thing that it will do is that it will make Bitcoin much more legitimate and visible, because being traded on those large exchanges is a big step and really shows that there is a trust from financial institutions, that the Bitcoin is there to stay.
Dr. Marianne Kam is optimistic.
Yes, I think it's a good sign. And we have to see that for a lot of countries where the currency of the country is very volatile, where there's no trust in financial institution, Bitcoin can be extremely useful.
Veronica Alishina there with this week's Please Explain on Bitcoin.
On the Money, get your shake of the sauce bottle.
The NBN is advertised as ultra-fast internet, with users theoretically being able to download a 200-megabyte television episode in less than half a minute. However, many users have failed to experience the high speeds of the NBN due to various crippling issues with the service. The issues have been so severe, NBN providers Telstra and Optus have announced they will be offering refunds and compensation to over 40,000 customers whose current internet speeds aren't even reaching half of the advertised speed. But not everyone will be getting a refund. Issues regarding the national broadband network came to a head recently when Telstra and Optus promised to begin offering refunds and other forms of compensation to users who were severely affected by the poor speeds provided by the service. Despite the compensation coming towards these customers and businesses, many people have been forced to live with minimal phone or internet access for months as technicians fail to address their problems. Associate Professor Robert Melani of the School of Electrical Engineering at the University of Sydney explains how customers can have wildly varying experiences on the NBN.
The most critical factors influencing that speed that someone actually gets will be their distance from the node, but it could be also related to some extent to their internet service provider, how much bandwidth they've actually purchased off the NBN. Because if they haven't purchased enough bandwidth and they've got too many customers, they've got more data than what they actually can handle, that's actually also a potential bottleneck. But my guess is that the number one factor is just the fact that we're using copper and a lot of those premises are sitting downstream by a few kilometres along that copper line.
However, the NBN has advertised speeds of up to 100 megabits per second. This means that while some people may only be getting a tenth of that speed, someone in Australia would still be getting close to what is advertised. Associate Professor Melani explains.
When you get these speeds, they're almost like optimal speeds or theoretical maximums. So, you know, it's almost like, for example, with fiber to the node that, you know, you would, if you're the first house on the street, the first house closest to the node, and you had the channel or the fiber all to yourself, then everything would be fine and you would get that kind of probably close to that speed. The problem is, in practice, there's, you know, hundreds of people using that same channel or that same fiber, and there's lots of those people are downstream, say, several kilometers away. So saying it's, again, it comes back to this phrase, up to. In principle, that's true, but in practice, it's not true.
Carrie Collison is a book publisher, having published the memoirs of former high-ranking Australians such as Sir Peter Cosgrove, Quinton Bryce and Michael Jeffrey. However, his business in Victoria, Siddharta Publishers, has experienced a significant downturn in productivity since connecting to the NBN. He explains how it began.
Well, the technicians rocked up here on the 28th of February. There were three of them. They were here for an hour and a half. They couldn't do the job properly. They kept on replacing the modems. And then finally they went away. Within an hour, I lost my landline. And that's when my problems started.
The reported issues can vary between different customers. Some may have phone services cutting out, slow internet speeds, or even no internet at all. For Mr. Collison, he has to face the prospect of being unable to use his landline to contact any of his several hundred authors, or get contacted by any prospective ones.
when I lost my landline immediately, I lost all contact with all of my authors. And I had been advertising heavily in the country through the Reader's Digest, which is not a cheap advertising format to take. And we suddenly lost all that income and all of that communication. And people who phoned me, they would be on the phone for about 5 or 10 seconds, and the phone would just have static and then cut out.
Mr. Collison contacted his phone and NBN provider Telstra for assistance, who sent out several technicians to his company with no success. So he contacted the Telecommunications Industry Ombudsman for assistance.
So then the Ombudsman phoned me to see if there was any progress with the problem. And while they were on the phone, it dropped out. The Ombudsman phoned me back, it dropped out. So then they phoned me back a third time, and I gave them my mobile number. They phoned me on that, then they appreciated immediately what was happening to me. They then pressed Telstra to do more for me, so they sent out a technician. That was one of 5 technicians that arrived over the next 4 months. All they did was replace the modem. There's nothing wrong with these Vietnamese-made modems, but they just simply replaced the modems, went away and said it's fixed when it wasn't.
Telstra have since announced they will be offering refunds to broadband customers due to a study conducted by the ACCC revealing about half of the customers on the 100 megabits per second plan were not able to reach that speed. Associate Professor Malani explains how Telstra were able to advertise the high speeds despite it not being true.
Yeah, I think the phrase to watch out for is up to. If that was replaced by average speed, or even better, minimum speed, there would be a lot less trouble, I think. So the phrase up to is a little bit misleading. It's a bit like when you go into a store and it might say up to 90% off. You might find one or two items there that are actually, you can find that are 90% off. Whereas when we say up to, when a telco says, say, up to 100 megabits per second, the problem is no one's getting that. And I think that the sort of credibility problem that the telcos are having.
Despite the fact that his issues were not related to the low internet speeds of the NBN, Mr. Collison believes he should still be entitled to compensation as well.
When I make these statements, I'm not after money from Telstra because I feel that they should just dip into their pockets. They have cost me a loss of $160,000 in revenue this year. Now I've got to rebuild that myself. I've had to dip into my own super fund to rebuild it and keep the company going.
Associate Professor Malani also reflects on the future of the NBN and how the service providers could improve on the connections to the NBN for future customers.
There's several things there. It depends what they're saying is the optimal speed. If they're actually advertising at 100 megabits per second, then in reality, to really deliver that on that promise, you would actually then have to go to the alternate architecture, which is fiber, all the way to the premise. So, again, it's what they're actually advertising is the key thing. Again, the optimal speed is even much, much higher than 100 megabits per second, and principal fiber can take thousands of gigabytes per second data. So it's really a question of what they're actually claiming the technology can deliver.
Associate Professor Robert Malani of the University of Sydney ending that report. I'm Kevin Suarez, and you're listening to On the Money, broadcasting around Australia on the Community Radio Network from the studios of Radio 2SER in Sydney. And now for our review segment, Read, Watch, Listen, with Veronica Alishina.
Package Design in Japan is a beautiful coffee table book published by one of my personal favourite publishing houses, Tashin Books. Author D. Frick speaks to Japanese designers about their inspiration and about the national religion of Japan, Shinto. According to Shinto, all materials and objects contain a living spirit or a true essence of that material. And for this reason, Japanese designers are very intentional in their use of materials and shapes so as not to pervert this true essence. The stunning photography throughout showcases gorgeous examples of this careful and meaningful packaging design process. If you are in the advertising or design business, this will serve as an excellent source of both aesthetic and conceptual inspiration.
Veronica Alishina, ending that review on the book Package Design in Japan by Dee Frick. I'm Kevin Suarez, and you're listening to On the Money, broadcasting around Australia on the Community Radio Network from the studios of Radio 2SER in Sydney. If you have any questions about money, finance, and business, tweet us at On the Money on Twitter. And that's all we have for you today on the Money. Thanks to our executive. Thanks to our executive producer, Roderick Chambers, producers Tanya Katsanis, Hans Lee, and Veronica Alishina. On the Money is produced in the studios of Radio 2SER for the Community Radio Network. You can find all of our shows and stories at 2ser.com/onthemoney. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or your favourite podcast app. Put it on your friend's phone as well. Follow us on Twitter and look for @onthemoney2ser. And find us on Facebook. I'm Kevin Suarez. We'll be back again next week to give you the inside running on all things financial. Thanks for your company.
We lost the great soul singer Sharon Jones last year, but she and her band The Dab Kings hit the highs one more time on Soul of a Woman, the 2SER feature album this week. Oh yeah! Oh yeah! Oh yeah! Oh yeah! Get deep into Soul of a Woman on 2SER's Breakfast, Drive and Static Where You Can Win copies. If I do to you, Soul of a Woman from Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. The feature album on 2SER 107.3. Stories, ideas, music. Now if you seem to
get off track, I'll be there to... Have you ever wondered why you like some foods and dislike others? These patients already are quite vulnerable. If you are putting more strain on their mental health, what effect is this having?
You know, the big thing is it makes them feel like prisoners. It just reduces their autonomy, and anyone that you work in mental health will tell you the importance of autonomy in mental health care.
I think that we have a responsibility as people working in the field to really help to increase public understanding around this condition.
Think Health, new thinking and new evidence. Sunday mornings at 10 on 2SER 107.3.
Fresh perspectives on local and international stories.
Once you get out there on your own, if you get the gutter again, you go back where you come from.
We want to leave this country in as good a state as when we first came.
There's a neighbourhood and a wealth in our neighbourhood.
You can have too much dignity in this world.
The Wire, weekdays at 6 p.m. on 2SER 107.3.
SER is a bit like your mum. We're on Facebook. But instead of awkwardly commenting on your status updates, we're keeping you up to date with everything that's going on here at the station. We like you. We really like you. So complete the circle of like at facebook.com/2SERFM. Stories.